dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Richard Miniter. I'm filling in for Frank Gaffney, who's off, as usual, saving the world. You may know me from my book, Mastermind, The Life of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the Planner of the 9/11 Attacks. But today we're talking to Bill Harlow, who for many years was the spokesman for the CIA, worked with George Tenet and other CIA directors, and was a captain in the United States Navy. For yet those of you who don't know the Navy, that's not like a Marine Corps captain at all. A Navy captain is just below admiral. And today we're talking about Hard Measures, a book he helped Jose Rodriguez with, who did interrogations for the CIA, and saved a lot of lives through asking a lot of hard questions. Hey, Bill, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much.
Now, in the book, you talk about a lot of the critics of hard measures, of using interrogation to find out what's inside terrorists' heads. We've got satellites that are very good at taking pictures of the tops of their heads, but to stop operations, we need to know what's going on inside their heads. Why do you think that this controversy began about the kind of enhanced interrogation measures that the CIA was using?
Well, it's kind of troubling to us. We found that immediately after 9/11 and for a year or two thereafter, there was a consensus in the United States that the U.S. intelligence services had to do whatever necessary in order to prevent another attack like 9/11. But as time passed, memories faded, and suddenly politicians who were very supportive and were urging the CIA to do whatever it took suddenly developed amnesia, and all of a sudden they started saying, well, how could you be so mean to these nice terrorists? And so when Jose wrote Hard Measures, what he wanted to do was to set the record straight, to remind people of what was going on in 2001, 2002, 2003, and why the CIA took aggressive measures as it did in order to protect American lives.
And this was a decision made by the President of the United States, George W. Bush, at the time, in concert with the Justice Department. And isn't it, in fact, the case that there were a number of regulatory restrictions? It wasn't the CIA was at some mysterious black site doing more or less whatever it wanted. Usually there was a doctor and a translator in the room with the interrogators, and the people who would do the waterboarding wouldn't be the same people who would lead the debriefing or the questioning. Is that right?
You're right. It was a very carefully controlled program, very well-regulated, supervised, much more so than almost any other program that people at the agency could recall. It was not a group of people just making it up as they went along. There were very strict rules and guidelines on how various enhanced interrogation techniques could be employed. And those rules and regulations were followed very carefully.
Now, the enhanced interrogations procedures is basically a staircase of 11 or so steps, which become progressively harder as you move along. I think number four is the belly slap, in which the fingers have to be spread, and you have to get permission in writing 24 hours in advance to slap the detainee once in the belly in order to compel some cooperation. Can you tell us about some of the other measures and some of the other restrictions so that we get a full sense of what it's like to be in that room and the limits placed on the interrogation team?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that a lot of people, when they hear about enhanced interrogation, immediately think about waterboarding. And what's important to remember is that waterboarding was used on only three of the most serious terrorists that were in our custody. The vast majority of the 100 or so terrorists who were in CIA custody received no enhanced interrogation. Only about 30 received any steps, and again, only three of those 30 received waterboarding. Most of them received much lighter techniques, things as simple as grabbing them by the collar and yanking them forward to look them in the eye, you know, or slapping them with an open hand so that they wouldn't be hurt.
Step number four.
Jose writes in Hard Measures, many of these techniques were essentially bluffs. They were just designed to get the attention of the terrorists, to let them know that things were not going to be the way they thought they were. Some of the terrorists, when they were captured, said to us, well, we'll talk to you when we get to New York and meet our lawyer. And they were just designed to get their attention, to let them know that they weren't in charge. They weren't going to tell the U.S. Intelligence community how things were going to proceed. And once they got the message that they weren't in charge, many of them quickly decided that their lives would be a lot better if they start cooperating, and cooperate they did.
That's right. One of those techniques was walling, where you'd throw a detainee against a fake wall that would fall back about 2 or 3 inches and make a loud noise that was supposed to shock them. But I think what you're referring to earlier is that almost half, maybe two-thirds of detainees either because of the shock of capture or other means, just cooperated from the beginning without having to go through any of these so-called hard measures. And most of these measures aren't very hard. I mean, waterboarding only applied to 3 of the Al-Qaeda detainees, but something like 60,000 American servicemen had gone through that since 1970 in escape and evasion school and elsewhere. Probably you yourself went through SEER school.
I went through a version of it. I wasn't waterboarded, but I went through some similar kind of training, and many U.S. service people have done so. And actually, the waterboarding that was done in the SEER training was considerably harder than what was encountered by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, or Abu Zubaydah, or Nashiri, the guy who was behind the attack on the USS Cole. So those three people experienced some waterboarding. They were made uncomfortable for a few minutes during a few weeks in their first month of custody, but nothing like what others have gone through. And it certainly, while it was difficult and certainly unpleasant for them, we were assured in writing by the U.S. Justice Department that it was not torture, that it was legal. And we know that the techniques were helpful in saving American lives.
Now, you don't mention him by name in the book, but I noticed that on page 55 you refer to a former FBI special agent who's been aggressively telling stories about how he and his colleagues got good information. This is a quote. And then on page 59 the book says that it didn't really work out as well as the FBI seemed to have thought. They tried to use the fact that, I think you're talking about Ali Soufan, was an Arab-American, and he offered up a Snickers bar, and the idea that the terrorists would trade his heritage for a Snickers bar was counterproductive. Then he tried his Arab-American heritage, and the detainee responded, "You're the worst kind of Arab. You're a traitor." Then he tried to offer him money. "What makes you think I would turn my back on Allah for money?" he said. So, I mean, is it the case that a lot of this criticism that emerges out of the federal government is really a rivalry with the FBI? Their techniques simply weren't working. The CIA techniques were. And the FBI was also more focused on trying to make a case rather than get life-saving information about future attacks. They were trying to make a case about prior attacks in order to convict someone of a crime.
Right. I mean, the FBI does great work, and we work closely with them around the world, and their focus has traditionally been trying to prove who was guilty of a past crime. That was not what the CIA was interested in doing at the black sites, where we had the small number of top Al-Qaeda operatives. We were trying to stop the next crime, trying to find out what was in their minds, what was going to happen down the road. And as you say, this one former FBI agent, Ali Soufan, has been running around telling the world that he got all the great information out of Abu Zubaydah, the first major operative that we captured prior to EIT's enhanced interrogation techniques being applied, and that if we had only listened to him, we would have gotten much more information without having to be so mean to these nice terrorists. Well, the fact of the matter is that Ali Soufan was at the black site for just a matter of a month or so prior to any enhanced interrogation techniques being applied. He left long before they were. One of the reasons they had to be applied was because Abu Zubaydah shut down because he was unhappy with the way he had been treated by Ali Soufan. And we didn't have time to wait to bond with these terrorists. We were quite certain that there was a second wave of attacks coming. And if we didn't get information out of them, that thousands of Americans and thousands of other innocent people around the world might die. And so it was felt at the time that we needed to move aggressively to take these hard measures in order to find out what they had in information they had in their head, we did find that information out, it did stop follow-on attacks, and the world is better off because of it.
Yeah, very good point. Thanks, Bill. Thanks for joining us on Secure Freedom Radio. It's about the end of our segment. I think the point of this, though, is that you're either hard on the terrorists or you're hard on the innocent civilians. You either have the information that saves lives or you don't. We should probably be grateful to the CIA and Jose Rodriguez and other people who work with Bill Harlow for getting the information that they did. Thanks again, Bill, and you can check him out at 15secondsblog.com. And more importantly, you can also check out the book Hard Measures, the Jose Rodriguez book that tells the inside story of the interrogation techniques against Abu Zubaydah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and others. The website is www.hardmeasures.us.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any other junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Richard Viniter filling in for Frank Gaffney, who's off, as usual, saving the world. And don't forget to check out my book, Mastermind, about the life of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who planned the 9/11 attacks. But I'm joined now by Richard Perle. I'm sure everyone in this audience knows who he is, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan days, and worked for Senator Scoop Jackson, Henry Jackson, from a Democrat from Washington, and lately of the Defense Policy Board, worked with Rumsfeld there. Richard, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Let's start with the news of the NATO summit and go to Afghanistan and nuclear policy. But is NATO an outmoded institution? Is NATO serving a constructive function other than to subsidize the defense of Europeans who are not prepared to cut back on their welfare state to pay for their own defense?
Well, it is certainly doing that. And it's been doing that for a long time, even during the Cold War. Yes, it's outmoded. Yes, it has not yet found the mission to follow the Cold War mission. But one dismantles an organization like this very carefully, because putting it together again, if the world changes and NATO is prepared for a new vitality, could be very difficult. So I think of it as kind of a shell corporation that you hold on to because there may be a business opportunity sometime in the future when you'll need a shell corporation.
One of those dead letter shell companies that you buy and put the hot new software project into later.
Exactly, because it is not performing very well now. And you won't hear that from NATO officials, and you won't hear it from governments attending NATO meetings, because it's in everybody's interest to maintain the fiction that NATO is functioning. But it really isn't.
Well, I guess it's better to go to a meeting in Brussels or Bonn than in Ouagadougou or, for that matter, Baghdad these days. But aside from that, though, if we were rethinking NATO, if we use this NATO summit as a moment to sort of rethink NATO policy, I think dismantling it is one option, but as you say, probably not the desirable one. But what about putting more requirements on the Europeans? For example, half of German naval Coast Guard vessels have radios, and every other month they give the other half of the boats the radios, and they swap them back and forth to save money. The Brits are about to decommission their one and only aircraft carrier and share an aircraft carrier with the French. You have exactly one aircraft carrier. Is it time to put some military requirements so that NATO, our European members of NATO, have some real military capabilities?
Well, it would be a very good thing if our European allies did have some capability, but I don't think they would be responsive. I don't think we're in a position to press them to do it. We can ask them to do it, but they are driven by their own agenda. They don't like spending money on defense. That was true even before the current financial crisis, which is now reaching a fever pitch with Greece on the brink. So I think the prospects of persuading the Europeans to do more are really very dim. They know they need to.
Yeah, they certainly know it. But what if we weren't talking about aircraft carriers or even ship radios, but building some capabilities and capacities for cyber warfare? We've seen the number of Chinese-led attacks, both against the Pentagon and U.S. Installations, but also against their European counterparts, has surged. I mean, more than 30,000 a month are reported in Germany alone, directed most likely by the Chinese. Would it make sense for NATO to have some sort of cyber terrorism and some cyber warfare capability, certainly more than it has now?
Well, what that is likely to mean in the real world is the United States providing our allies with advanced cyber anti-attack capabilities. There's not a lot of software innovation taking place now in Europe, and they're just not devoting the resources even to something like that. So I think the Europeans for a long time now have been shirking their responsibilities, and I think they're going to go on doing so.
So if you've got your brother-in-law living on your couch, you can tell him about the benefits of employment, but he's not likely to get off it anytime soon. Moving along to sticking with the NATO summit here, though, were you surprised by the fact that the White House had invited Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari?
Well, I think they thought this was clever diplomacy. I think our problems with Pakistan run very deep. And mobilizing NATO to lean on Pakistan is not going to succeed, in my view. The Pakistanis understand one thing very clearly, and that is that we are on our way out of Afghanistan, and they will still be there after we're gone. And so they're going to do their own thing. And that would be true even if you didn't have the added problem of growing radicalism, including among the military in Pakistan. So I think the surface diplomacy isn't going to deal with what are some profound differences in thinking about the future between us and Pakistan, between the West and Pakistan.
For more than 5.5 months, the Pakistanis have been forbid all ground transfers of equipment for our troops in Afghanistan. It's basically these supplies, this cargo, has to land in Karachi or other Pakistani ports and go overland into Afghanistan. It's hard to do that by air, given the weight and the cost. But for 5.5 months, they've stopped our trucks from rolling. The idea here, I think, of President Obama's team of inviting Zardari to the NATO summit was to sort of put some pressure on him to open up those routes and allow our cargo to move again. If you were advising President Obama, how would you persuade the Pakistanis to let us continue to supply our troops in our waning days in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, I would not have permitted the situation to develop where these are seen as our waning days. We did not have to declare we're leaving by a date certain. We could have said that our prosecution of the war in Afghanistan would reflect conditions on the ground, and that might have made a difference. But when you're on your way out, you can hardly expect the people who are still going to be there to stop thinking about what it's going to be like once you're gone. So we don't have a lot of influence now in Pakistan.
Well, certainly the Russian experience. Certainly the Russian experience showed that when they announced that they were leaving on a date certain that X number of troops would be across the Oxus River by January 1, 1989, 1988 was the bloodiest year of the Afghan War. So, I mean, it seems as if this administration has ignored the Russian experience in Afghanistan and the dangers of setting timelines. But all that said, I mean, assuming that Obama has announced, and as he did, that we'd be virtually all out by 2014, what would you do now to sort of get the Pakistanis to open up the routes, or is it impossible?
Well, I think it's highly unlikely. We give them a certain amount of aid, and so do some other countries. I suppose that if we all got together and said not another penny until those routes are open, the government might feel obliged to respond. But we don't tend to do that sort of thing. Just as we continue to supply aid to countries that routinely oppose us at the UN and elsewhere, so it would be hard to make that credible. Since the history is we never play hardball like that.
Yes, we spend something like $3.4 billion a year on non-military aid and supply an fully undocumented amount of military aid to the Pakistanis, including a lot of things which really have no counterterrorism application, like deep sea mines and submarine detectors, which really enables them to have a capacity against the Indians. What if we put pressure on some of those things that are not useful to us in the war on terror, but are useful against the Indians, that we withheld those things or slowed down the supply of spare parts, that type of thing? Do you think that would have an impact?
Yes. I think if we believed that it was crucial to reopen the supply lines, and we were prepared to go quite far in order to pressure the Pakistanis to do it, we would, of course, threaten the military assistance that Pakistan now receives from us, and other assistance as well. And I would go after all of it.
But you think that perhaps it's very useful to the Obama administration to have this supply crisis with the routes shut down in Pakistan, because it enables them to speed up the withdrawal from Afghanistan and therefore accomplish a thorny political goal for President Obama?
I think this president has shown a readiness to abandon activities like the continuing conflict in Afghanistan if he thinks it's in his political interest. He doesn't need excuses. And he's already done most of the damage by announcing we're going to be out by 2014. What is now going on in Afghanistan, and what will continue until our final departure, is a struggle for who's going to rule Afghanistan once we're gone. And it's the end game, and that's when people redouble their efforts, because the future is about to be settled. There's no longer great uncertainty about how much we're going to be able to influence matters. So it was inevitable that we would find ourselves in this situation.
Well, inevitable, but I guess there's still time to change it. This is Richard Miniter talking to Richard Pearl. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm filling in for Frank Gaffney. We'll be back next with Ambassador Roger Noriega on the threat from Latin America. Richard, thank you very much for joining us on Secure Freedom Radio.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Richard Miniter, author of Mastermind. I'm filling in for Frank Gaffney, off saving the world. And I'm joined now by Ambassador Roger Noriega. No man knows more about things south of the border than Roger Noriega, and we're on the line with him now. Roger, more than 60,000 people are dead in Mexico from the drug war over the past 10 years, and that instability is creeping into the United States with shootouts on our border and, of course, a flood of drugs coming in. But it's as bad as it is in the United States, it's far worse south of the border. If you were advising the next president of the United States, what would you say is Mexico a place of major concern? Should we be watching the border with some apprehension?
I think so. You know, first off, the Mexicans are fighting our drug war. In my opinion, the United States needs to accept a certain amount of responsibility for the fact that our consumption rates have caused this problem, consumption of illegal drugs. And I used to be very critical of the Mexicans when they weren't taking this problem on themselves, but now President Calderon is doing that, and most of the killings are a result of turf wars provoked by the disruption of the gangs, by arrests and all of that. But the fact is that Mexicans are paying a very dear price for this, and the presidential candidates particularly the front runner, who's likely going to be elected, Enrique Peña Nieto, is someone who some have raised doubts about whether he's going to be as committed to this fight. He says publicly that he will, but we're going to have a strategy to not only step up our support, material, intelligence cooperation, law enforcement cooperation, but also the diplomacy with Mexico to really press the new government to continue this offensive, because if they don't, if they go back to the old truces of the past where they made agreements, de facto agreements with the narcos to leave them alone, that's going to spell terrible news for the United States, for well-being of our citizens. So we have to get have a strategy. Unfortunately, the Obama administration apparently does not have one. They're actually going to cut assistance to Mexico next year. And you really don't see them. I mean, Obama's ambassador was even ousted by the Mexicans a year ago. So I just really don't think they're very sure-footed on how to deal with this very important crisis right on our border.
Yeah. By the way, we're talking again to Roger Noriega. Ambassador Noriega was the Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere under President George W. Bush. Look, but the problem is even worse than that, right? The United States did cooperate into a program, sometimes known as Fast and Furious or Project Gunrunner, that supplied upwards of 3,000 firearms, many of them fully automatic machine guns and sniper rifles, to the Mexican drug cartels. The Mexican reaction to that has been not very well covered inside the United States, but the Mexican reaction has been very negative, as if amidst this death toll, this ongoing turf war and the drug battle that's claimed more than 60,000 Mexican lives, we added to it. We literally have Mexican blood on our hands. What should the next president do to react to that?
Well, first and foremost, I think that we need to come clean about this debacle. Up to the highest levels of our government, we have to show that we're going to be accountable for these kinds of mistakes. And you see the Holder Justice Department stiff-arming the Congress. People have a right to know who played a role in these decisions. What American would have thought that the U.S. ATF was actually putting arms in the hands of drug traffickers? It doesn't even make good nonsense, as my old boss Jesse Helms would say. And we need to come clean here.
It's like a bad movie plot, but
yeah, absolutely. And it has to be some accountability at the highest levels to demonstrate to the Mexicans that we're going to take this as seriously as we expect them to take it.
But one of the real problems is that as we retreat from Afghanistan, we're making deals with the Taliban, either formally or informally. And the Mexicans want to, because this is a reversion to their past pattern, make deals with the various drug cartels, truces, I think you referred to them earlier. How can we argue that the Mexicans should continue fighting their war against the drug cartels, which we're essentially financing through purchasing illegal drugs in the United States, while at the same time we're making deals to exit Afghanistan? It seems like we're advising our neighbor to continue to wage war against a problem that bedevils us while retreating from another one.
Right. Well, it's a very good point, but the problem is the Mexicans are going to be sitting right there. They're not going anywhere, and allowing their institutions to be hollowed out by this kind of drug corruption really will stunt its growth as a modern economy, and it will be able to compete in the world and create economic opportunity for its people. But the rule of law is a fundamental building block, and hopefully they won't be as cynical about their own territory as we are in making some deals in Afghanistan. I agree with you 100%. Our credibility sort of shot on this, but the Mexicans, I think, recognize for themselves that that's what the fight is all about. It's about defending the rule of law, about building a modern state. And you can't do that when you make truces with narco traffickers and say that you won't apply the law to them and expect that it's going to be applied fairly to everybody else in the country. So I think the Mexicans, it's in our own interest, and we understand that. But, you know, we need to do more in terms of our our own contribution to what's happening there.
Well, the Mexicans could ask us for more, right? I mean, Southcom is one of those military regional commands, but it's actually based in the southern United States. Would it make sense to give Southcom more resources and perhaps move the center of its operations to Mexico or Latin America in order to put those military assets closer and to build more relationships with the Mexicans and other regional partners?
Well, in this case, the area of operation would be NORTHCOM's. And the second important point, and really the most important point, is that the Mexicans would not accept that kind of a military role from the United States. They are accepting an unprecedented level, historic level of cooperation with U.S. law enforcement in their territory, and that we have to preserve. They won't allow any sort of foreign military presence. Of course, we cooperate particularly with the Mexican Navy on this in this problem, but we don't have U.S. troops in Mexico proper.
Well, I wasn't talking about troops. I mean, it's sort of deploying advisors and building relationships on both on intelligence and on military capacities and capabilities. I mean, isn't there more military to military and police to police that we could be doing?
You're right. Your fundamental point is correct, and we are doing more of that now. But it's something that historically the Mexicans have been very wary about, and we it's always two steps forward and one or two back when we're trying to build this military to military relationship, build stronger institutions that can take on the problem. The Mexican Navy is more open. And then law enforcement has been open. One thing I don't want to sugarcoat here is, several Mexican generals, retired and even active duty, or have been arrested in recent days for cooperating with the narco cartel. So, I mean, maybe that's going to be the two steps back in terms of the confidence that U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies have when it comes to cooperating with the Mexicans. If they feel that there are people that are not reliable in the room, it really undermines confidence on the part of U.S. law enforcement, which was built up because of the Mexican openness in recent years. But again, that's a real blow to our cooperation.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, corruption has really hollowed out the police. I mean, the old joke is that the cartels used to hire off-duty policemen. Now they hire on-duty uniformed policemen. But the corruption was mostly in the Mexican army kept to the lower levels, NCO level. But with this revelation about the three generals and other officers who appear to be connected to it, we have to wonder whether the corruption has spread deep into the officer ranks of the Mexican military, meaning that their American counterparts might be hard-pressed to who to deal with.
Right. Corruption is in the law enforcement and the military has been, and law enforcement has made it very, very tough for Mexicans to get their arms around this problem. And then they bring in the military. And people have been warning from the very beginning this is going to corrupt the military. And it's not the first time it's happened.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for our wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta system, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta system to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Richard Miniter filling in for Frank Gaffney, who's off saving the world. I'm joined now by Jim Robbins, the senior editorial writer for foreign policy at the Washington Times and the author of a new book just coming out in paperback in a few months, This Time We Win, The Definitive History of the Tet Offensive. It's not what the New York Times told you that it was, and you should read this book, This Time We Win. Jim, what we'd like to talk to you today about is this extraordinary story coming out of Pakistan about Dr. Shaquille Afridi, who ran a vaccination program for the CIA, and he's now been sentenced to 33 years in prison by the Pakistani government. Now, Afridi was a part of a very clever CIA program in 2010, where the CIA was trying to determine who lived in that mysterious concrete castle in Abbottabad. Was it bin Laden or somebody else? So they came up with the idea vaccinating all the children in the neighborhood and collecting blood samples and then doing a DNA comparison test. Of course, for his role in that effort to save American and Pakistani lives, he's been sentenced to 33 years in prison. First of all, does the verdict surprise you? And second of all, what do you think this tells us about the relationship between Pakistan and America today?
Well, it doesn't surprise me because, you know, the Pakistanis haven't really been very comfortable with how this all went down, of, you know, the U.S. going in and grabbing bin Laden. And we can speculate on how much Pakistan knew or whether they were actually hiding him. I mean, you know, that would all be speculative. But, I mean, from the point of view of those who thought that it was okay to give safe haven to Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, then, yes, someone like this might come across as a traitor. But, I mean, from our point of view, since Dr. Afridi was working with the CIA, and in fact, Secretary Panetta, or rather Director Panetta, or now Secretary, but then Director, said that, you know, confirmed it, that he had helped the CIA find bin Laden publicly. So, you know, to us, this guy is a great hero, but I don't think that we did him any favors by admitting publicly that he did what he did. You know, and trying to argue that, hey, you know, Pakistan, from your point of view, he shouldn't be considered a traitor because he was doing, you know, he was taking action against terrorism. So you really shouldn't consider him a traitor. So I think really we made a mistake in kind of affirming, you know, and outing him. Or another mistake might have been not getting him out of Pakistan.
Well, that's right. Why wasn't he given a visa for him and his family to come to the United States, you know, shortly after the operation or even before the operation commenced? But the larger problem that I think you're touching on is why, hours after bin Laden's death, President Obama told the world, literally on worldwide broadcast television, that bin Laden was dead, robbing the possibility of surprise for our special forces to swoop in on al-Qaeda, who might not be aware that bin Laden had passed, and exploit the intelligence in the compound to find and kill and capture more. And this is just a part of that, of giving up that benefit of surprise. Why do you think the president did give up the advantage of surprise? And why is the president doing so little to help this doctor in Pakistan and anyone, frankly, who helps us in Pakistan?
Well, it's the biggest news story of the year, of the decade, what have you. I mean,
that's why we're talking to you about it.
Yeah, I mean, we say why, you know, he made the announcement. I think it would have been hard to keep something like that under wraps. Also, if suppose we had killed him and not announced it, but then sort of rumors. It started coming out through rumor, and then later we confirmed it. I think that that would have just given the people who would want to argue that he was still alive more footing, because it would have been less clean. You know what I mean? Like it would have been sort of out there, oh, he's dead, and then the U.S. confirms that he's dead. But maybe by then al-Qaeda wouldn't have confirmed it, or, you know, it just could have gone wrong in a couple of ways. So I can understand,
Hang on, Jim,
both sides of it.
Are you really arguing that we couldn't have kept this secret for just a couple of weeks to exploit the intelligence value of what's in the compound? I mean, there are secrets from World War II, and there are certainly many secrets from the Cold War which have still not been made public. I mean, certainly the U.S. government has the ability to keep a secret.
Oh, does it?
I'm trying to see it from
their point of view. I mean, I understand the tactical advantages that we would have gained by not letting it be known, and particularly when you're talking about exploiting hot intelligence, and intelligence at that level, which is the hottest intelligence that could possibly be. I mean, you know, from bin Laden's compound, I mean, presumably every single aspect of the network was known at that point, I mean, as it existed the moment that he died. So, yeah, it probably would have been a very good idea to keep it under wraps at least for a few days. I don't know if it could have been kept under wraps for a few weeks is my point. But yeah, certainly not just announcing it immediately upon his death, because, yes, I think that did sacrifice a certain amount of exploitation value from what we got.
And also revealing, as the president didn't in his televised address, but certainly the senior national security team revealed that it was a SEAL unit, in fact, named SEAL Team 6 as the unit that took him out. Naming that unit, as you know, set off a firestorm inside the special forces community because they thought that made them targets. And the downing of a helicopter and killing of 22 SEALs in the month following the bin Laden raid tended to give the SEALs more support for that view that naming that unit was a bad idea. But, I mean, isn't it the case, though, that what Obama was really afraid of was not leaks from briefing Congress, because they had no obligation to brief Congress immediately after the raid, but briefs from his own national security team, perhaps briefs from Hillary's operation or Panetta's that might want to take credit for an operation that the president had opposed for months?
Oh, I'm sure. It could have been a lot of things like that. The internal dynamics of it, and also wanting to be able to control what got out, because as you mentioned, they, you know, trumpeted the fact that it was SEAL Team 6. They started working with Hollywood on this big movie. I mean, talk about a sort of naked exploitation for political gain of giving classified information to Hollywood so that they could make a nice movie about it, you know, just in time for the election. So politics and the internal struggles of the administration certainly played a role in this too. Again, whether we can say for sure that it would have been kept under wraps is another question. But probably a little bit of delay would have been extremely useful for tactical reasons, if nothing else.
Well, the president is on his way to the NATO summit this week. And President Zardari has been invited of Pakistan to join President Obama. And the idea is that if Zardari comes to the NATO summit, it's such a big honor that he will relent and let U.S. Cargo vessels land at the port of Karachi and U.S. military trucks roll across Pakistan and reopen the supply lines to our beleaguered forces in Afghanistan. It's been more than 5.5 months, and they've not been able to get the Pakistanis to pull up the roadblocks. Do you think, first of all, that the president has any chance of persuading President Zardari to let our troops reopen the supply lines? And secondly, if you were advising President Obama, what would you do to reopen those supply lines and re-equip our men in the field?
I don't think that simply talking to him, to President Zardari, is going to make a difference. You know, persuade him by what? Through the magic of his charisma or... You know, being invited to a summit meeting, I don't think that alone is going to do anything.
But, Jim, what if there are Greek columns involved and a lot of hope and change?
Yeah, they could give him an Obama 2012 T-shirt that might, you know, soothe him, a bumper sticker or something.
Or an iPod loaded with Obama's speeches. It was good enough for the Queen of England.
I know. It's good enough for the Queen of England. It's good enough for the President of Pakistan. So, yeah, things like that aren't going to make a difference. I mean, I think we're way beyond the point where Mr. Obama can change things but just by showing up, if he even could. I mean, we can go through that whole history. So probably if they want to get Pakistan to relent, it would have to be things like new promises of aid packages or something tangible, something that would really appeal to Pakistan, or maybe an official apology or some kind of official recognition that the U.S. was in the wrong for going in and grabbing bin Laden. Now, I'm not saying we were in the wrong, but from Pakistan's point of view, this is one of the reasons why they're blocking us, is they're offended by the whole thing. Not to mention that incident a few months ago where we went across the border and killed some of their troops, which I think was the catalyst for what's going on right now. So I think what they want us to do is basically apologize to them. So it won't be a question of how can we persuade you. It's will we bow to their demand that we take the blame for all this and put ourselves in the wrong? And I don't know if the president would be willing to do that in an election year. He's done it before, so it's possible.
Well, let's see if the apology tour works its charms, as it hasn't yet. But we were speaking to Jim Robbins, the senior editorial writer at the Washington Times and author of This Time We Win. This is Richard Miniter sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. Join us next time.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.